to be with you. On my mind this week, what a week.
Well, this bombshell hit tonight. President Trump tried to shut down the Federal Bureau of Investigation probe.
The outrages and shots just keep coming.
We'll look at these two different tweets from the president's Twitter account, and I'll read for you exactly what he said.
Whatsoever for us to absorb.
I think it would be helpful to have less drama emanating from the White House.
The Justice Department has appointed former FBI head Robert Mueller as special counsel to lead the Russia probe. President Trump tweeted, "This is the single greatest witch hunt of a politician in American history." So, first I talked with Charles Sykes. He's a former conservative talk show host. He gives us his take on the week's developments.
All of the doubts that are being raised are being raised because of things the president himself is doing. And that's what's so extraordinary about all of this, that almost all of these controversies are self-inflicted.
Then,
what's notable about partisan polarization in the country today is that it's not that everybody loves their own party. It's that we hate the other party.
Robert P. Jones on the seemingly intractable disunion in America today. First, Charles Sykes. He's author of a forthcoming book, How the Right Lost Its Mind. He joined me via Skype from Milwaukee. And Charlie, it's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Charlie, breaking as we speak is the news that Roger Ailes has died. For most of us, a major shock. What do you make of it?
Well, it is shocking in a year in which it seems like there's just breaking news every 5 minutes. But there's no question that Roger Ailes will be remembered as one of the most influential media figures of the last several decades. Someone who really shaped and reshaped the conservative movement for better and for worse.
So, what do you think, as far as Fox News is concerned, to have? We got a brand new chapter ahead of us.
Well, that's a very interesting question, because I think that Fox News is having a very hard time figuring out where it actually fits into the media ecosystem. They seem to almost be schizophrenic between the news side and the opinion side, figuring out how do you navigate this era of Trump. And it is interesting that just this week they've fallen into third place in the cable ratings after having dominated. And in part, I think it's because they're struggling to figure out how do we cover Donald Trump these days?
And what about the Murdoch sons? To what extent will they influence what goes next?
Well, they're in charge now, and obviously they understand they have a very serious problem. You had I want to be very respectful of the fact that Roger Ailes just passed away, but very clearly they had a very, very serious problem, and that they have to fix it. The climate at Fox News was absolutely toxic. The tradition and the culture of sexual harassment that went on for so long was absolutely appalling. And somehow they need to come to grips with that, at the same time coming to grips with what they do with their on-air personalities.
And the other news that is breaking today is in regard to the appointment of Mueller as a special prosecutor, special investigator. Where do you think that's going to go?
Well, several things. Number one, it clearly escalates the investigation into the Russia ties. It's very, very difficult for Donald Trump and his supporters to continue to argue that there's nothing there, that it's a fake story, when in fact you have a special prosecutor. So this is very bad news from the point of view of the White House, I think, because it means they have completely lost control of the process. It's probably good news for Republicans in Congress, because now they can push this off their plate and get back to talking about the Republican agenda. But I think it was interesting that last night the president put out a reasonable statement, sober statement about the appointment of the special prosecutor, but he couldn't contain himself. And this morning is is once again on a tweet storm complaining about the appointment of a special prosecutor. So I think you can tell that President Trump does not regard this as good news.
Well, not good news. And last Sunday in the New York Times, you wrote about anti-Trumpism. Tell us what you meant.
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon, the way that the conservative media is dealing with a lot of these stories, that many of them are less willing to actually defend Trump and more enthusiastic about attacking his critics. That's what I mean by anti-Trump, that there's a sort of a formula for the right-wing media. And I say this as somebody who was part of that for many, many years, which is to deflect, rationalize, but then to change the subject, to make the issue about the fake news media.
So what you've got, and you look at the mainstream media, you look at the legacy press and stuff like that, you see, oh, he ordered him to, you know, deep six the investigation. Not exactly.
Or hypocritical Democrats, or over-the-top liberals, or play the game that I call whataboutism, which is confronted with any sort of scandal to say, well, what about Obama? What about Clinton? What about this scandal? And I think that if you have that template in front of you, and then you watch what they're doing on Fox News or listening to conservative talk radio, you'll see the pattern, how you switch from defense to attack.
All right, we start tonight with the Trump-hating Washington Post. And last night, they released a story saying that President Trump gave the Russian foreign minister and ambassador classified information while they were visiting the White House last week. Now, this story has been denied by Trump administration officials who were actually in the room. But that does not stop the Destroy Trump media from running wild with all of this. Watch this biased, abusively biased.
What's kind of tragic about this from the conservative point of view is it means that rather than talking about conservative principles or ideas or putting the country first, what happens is that you have this reflexive desire simply to attack the other side, that as long as you're making liberal heads explode, then Trump must be doing something right.
But isn't that going to be somewhat more difficult to do now?
It's not difficult for the conservative media if this is your template. They are in the process of constructing a rather remarkable alternative reality. In downplaying the story, basically now saying that there's a plot, Sean Hannity will argue there's a plot to take down the president. And I think what you'll see is kind of the rallying of the troops, that Donald Trump is the victim and that people are trying to undo the election. And I must tell you, that's going to be very effective among the right-wing base.
But now, weren't you part of that for quite some time?
Oh, very much so, for 20 years. And this is one of the perspectives I hope to bring to this as someone who I know that if I, for example, yes, I was a conservative talk show host for 20 years, appalled by the rise of Donald Trump, appalled by what many conservatives have done, watching them abandon their principles and any sort of standards, I think, of truth. But I also then can sit back and think, okay, if I was a conservative talk show host today, and I wanted to keep my job and my audience, how would I handle this ongoing cascade of scandals? And it would be, of course, to engage in the anti-Trumpism, talk about how liberals are melting down or hysterical. And that is the formula that you're seeing.
So do you believe that those who supported Trump in the past, those who voted for him, those totally strong Trump supporters are going to stick by him because of those conservative talk show hosts, no matter what?
For the time being, yes. And it's not just because of the conservative talk show hosts. I think that a lot of the Trump supporters have a deep emotional investment in their vote. And even if they have doubts, they're going to be very, very reluctant in believing they made a terrible mistake. And so they will cling to things that confirm their bias, that make them feel good about their choice. To a certain extent, the talk show hosts are not necessarily the leaders here. They're also following. They also understand that if they were to go on the air and express fundamental doubts about Donald Trump's judgment, his character, and his behavior, that they would be crossways with their audience. So it's kind of an interesting chicken and egg, Diane, whether or not the base is influenced by the talk show hosts, or whether the talk show hosts are just simply afraid to break with the base.
You know, it's really fascinating that we learn very, very recently that Paul Ryan knew months before of a comment by Congressman McCarthy regarding Trump and others receiving money from the Russians, and that has now leaked out. What do you make of that, and how far will Paul Ryan go to continue to support Trump?
Well, so far, I'm not sure how significant that comment by McCarthy was. They're claiming now that it was a joke. I was not there in the room, to have heard that. I don't know how significant that was. But your second question, I think, is the most important. You know, Paul Ryan is not just the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Up until this year, he was really the intellectual leader of the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And yet he has made this calculation that he is going to support President Trump because he is rationalizing this, that Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, will sign conservative legislation, that the only way that he will get his agenda approved is through President Trump. And as long as he thinks, and he and his supporters think, that they are very, very close to getting all of these things that they've talked about, healthcare reform, tax reform, all of that signed into law, he's going to be very, very reluctant to break with the president. But the price tag for this political Faustian bargain is going up all the time. But I don't see any signs of him breaking with Trump in the near future.
You know Paul Ryan well, I gather, yes, and have known him for many years. He is a reader of the writings on the wall. How in the world are all these legislative items going to get passed in the midst of these kinds of investigations, both by Congress and by Robert Mueller?
Well, that's, again, this is the thing that I think to keep your eye on. And yes, I have known Paul Ryan, and I have a great deal of respect for him. I have been very, very disappointed by the way that he has handled this, although I understand the calculation that he's making. But your question, I think, goes to the heart of all of this. So what if you swallow all of your doubts? What if you compromise your principles and then discover, or wake up one morning and realize, you're not going to get anything for this? I think it's very possible, as you point out, that you could go through this the entire first year of the Trump presidency without having any major legislative accomplishments. So you've sold your soul for what? I don't know that Ryan is there at this point, but I also think that it's become obvious, as you point out, that the Trump scandals and Trump's behavior has absolutely eclipsed every part of the conservative Republican agenda. Everything is dead in the water. All of the momentum from the Obamacare repeal was dissipated. Tax reform is not going to happen this year. And if it doesn't happen this year, it's unlikely to happen next year. And I think you're starting to see this reflected in the markets. And by the way, that's the first time that's happened. This reality check, the whole quote-unquote Trump boom was predicated on the belief that Republicans could not possibly screw this up, right? They control the Senate, they control the House, they control the White House. Of course, they're going to cut taxes because this is what Republicans do. And now I think there's this recognition, uh-oh, this may not happen.
Charlie, how long do you think this whole process could take with Mueller at the head and the congressional investigations going on simultaneously. Do you think this is something that could move quickly, or do you think it's going to drag on for at least a year?
I don't know. That's the honest answer. But also, the judicial process tends to be very slow, tends to be slower than the political process. So there's certainly the possibility that this will drag on for a very long time. This is one of the reasons why I'm sure that the White House dreaded the idea of a special counsel, because, again, they have no control over it. And it can be very, very open-ended. So I don't think that this will go away anytime soon. And personally, I hope that Congress does not simply, you know, fold its tent because of the special counsel. The Congress has its own constitutional responsibilities here, and I hope they fulfill those as well.
You know, it's interesting. Earlier this week, Tom Friedman wrote that the Republican Congress will never stand up to Trump. Do you believe that?
Yes, I at least for the time being. Although, given how fast everything changes, everything needs to be, you know, hedged a bit. I will say this: that the Congress will never break with Trump until the conservative base moves, and I don't see that the conservative base is moving away from Trump. We do not live in an era with a great deal of profiles in courage, so I don't see that. I think the people who are talking about impeachment or the 25th Amendment, I certainly understand their point, but I also think that it's highly unrealistic.
The other thing that was written this week was by David Brooks, and I wondered about your reaction to this. He said that incompetents do not recognize that they are incompetent. And he was referring to Donald Trump. I wonder how you feel about that comment.
Well, I agree with that. There's actually a psychological term for people who don't know what they don't know, that people tend to always exaggerate their degree of knowledge. And I think that you've seen that over the last couple of years, both with the president and with many of his supporters. And maybe it's one of the reasons why we're willing to accept so much. But he's absolutely right. You get the sense that that Donald Trump is not burdened by a great deal of self-awareness. Let me put it that way.
There are even some who are concerned about his mental health.
I always caution not to engage in exaggeration or hyperbole, but I don't know how you do not at some point say, Is the president okay? Is the president? I mean, it's one thing to say that the president is, you know, the people in power are egomaniacs. There's one thing to say that someone's a narcissist. But here is a man who is just so notably lacking in judgment and self-control that it is disturbing. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that I'm a psychologist or play that, but all of the doubts that are being raised are being raised because of things the president himself is doing. And that's what's so extraordinary about all of this, that almost all of these controversies are self-inflicted.
Charlie, it's up to the voters in 2018, clearly. Do you think this whole controversy is going to continue right up to those midterm elections?
I think that one thing that we have learned from the Trump candidacy and the Trump presidency is that whatever is going on is going to continue. The president is not going to change. He is not going to pivot. He is not going to grow. Staff changes are not going to fix what is wrong with this presidency. Now, how it plays out, I don't know, because we're living in a period where week to week, you cannot predict what the next big story is going to be. You think about what's happened in the last 8-9 days and how extraordinary that has been. Is there any reason to believe that that pace is not going to continue? Well, maybe the pace won't continue, but there are so many shoes left to drop. The president has picked a fight with the intelligence community, with the FBI, with the federal judiciary. His personal erratic behavior. I don't see that changing. I expect that there'll be a blow up in the White House at some point in terms of the staffing. So, yes, in answer to your question, I expect that this drama is going to continue. How the public will react is unpredictable, whether they will simply become exhausted and numbed and shrug their shoulders and turn to other things. I don't know. But I do know that elected Republican officials are getting increasingly nervous.
President Trump had the authority to fire the director of the FBI. Could we see the same thing happen with a special prosecutor?
Anything is possible with this president. I think the day before he fired Director Comey, most people would have said, well, yes, he has the power to do it, but he would never do that because of the fallout from that, because of the norms and the traditions. This is a president who does not care about the norms and the traditions. Now, would that be the breaking point for Republicans if he were to fire Robert Mueller? That may be. Robert Mueller is, as far as I can tell, probably one of the most respected investigators in Washington.
A straight shooter.
Independent, a straight shooter. So, I would like to say that's inconceivable, but with Donald Trump, nothing is inconceivable.
Charlie, where are you personally in regard to Donald Trump at this point?
Well, I haven't changed my opinion from the moment that he descended the golden escalator, that he's a man that is absolutely unfit to be the president. But I will tell you that the last year as a conservative has been a disillusioning slog for me. I'm alarmed at what I'm seeing. I'm alarmed at the compromises that so many conservatives have made. And I'm deeply concerned about the damage that he can do, not just politically, but also to the culture and to the country.
Charlie Sykes, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And now a quick break. And we're back. Now, Robert P. Jones, he's CEO of the Public Religion Institute and the author of a book titled The End of White Christian America. Earlier this month, he wrote about America's political disunion for the New York Times. He joined me in our studio. Robbie, it's great to talk with you again.
Thanks. I'm glad to be back with you.
Thank you. So it seems that with every single political news story, there seem to be two polar opposite versions and opposite reactions. Earlier this week, front page news in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and others were absolutely aghast at President Trump's decision to share classified information. Fox News expressed outrage over how this information got out, not the shocking fact that it actually happened. So what you say is that there's real evidence that our shared sense of national identity is unraveling. So explain your evidence.
Well, you know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about the big picture. You know, in my day job, I am tracking a lot of these kinds of issues that you're talking about at the CEO of Public Religion Research Institute. And so I'm looking at immigration. We're looking at foreign policy. But I began to take a step back and to think about what are the bigger pieces moving here. And it began, you know, it just occurred to me that first of all, we really are at a tipping point in our country today, you know, in terms of demographic and cultural change. In the last decade, as I wrote about in my book, The End of White Christian America, we have shifted from being a majority white Christian nation to a minority white Christian nation. We have gone from being 54% white and Christian at the beginning of President Obama's first term to being only 43% white and Christian at the end of his first term in the election of Donald Trump. This is a huge cultural shift in the country. And part of what we're seeing and what I'm arguing is that the two political parties are actually now reorienting themselves less along kind of what we've been thinking about as liberal to conservative lines and more along very different and even polar opposite reactions to this cultural change in the country. And that's driving a lot of the chaos that I think we're seeing in our partisan politics.
And what is, define for us this cultural change? I realize that you've got Christians as a minority. You've got all kinds of changes going on. But there are other things besides Christianity, sort of white Christianity, yep, losing its majority.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're right. It's a lot of things. I mean, so we're seeing demographic change. You know, if you're only looking at demographics, the Census Bureau is still telling us by the early 2040s that we will be a majority non-white nation. In the last couple of years, they've already the Census Bureau also has said that majority of the kids in our public schools are not white. The majority of babies born in the U.S. are not white. And I think this kind of sense of things shifting and us being at this tipping point is there. And then we also have the economic, the kind of globalization and the shifting of our whole economic infrastructure, particularly manufacturing jobs, that is, I think, undercutting a sense of American security and, you know, what is America a kind of manufacturing powerhouse, you know, with white working class people being its base? Or, you know, are we this kind of tech society and service society, which looks very different than it did a generation ago?
When you talk about a sense of American security, do you mean among the people themselves?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that one of the problems we're having is that we're having a hard time, I think, with all of this change, telling a coherent story about who we are as a country and where we're going, maybe more importantly than that. You know, in some ways we had in this last election cycle, maybe even a perfect caricature of this in our two parties' candidates. You know, on the one hand, we had Donald Trump with his very retro farmer hat looking. It wasn't like a kind of modern, you know, prep boy, prep school hat or a frat boy hat. It was like this old school farmer hat that you'd buy at the seed store, you know, that harkened back to this kind of former agricultural time and very explicitly make America great again, right? This kind of looking backward motif. And then you had Hillary Clinton with this very savvy, social media friendly, big H, stylized H with the arrow pointing forward, right? And stronger together, you know, with this kind of let's go forward. The survey data actually bears this out, that our two political parties are really reacting quite differently. There was an Associated Press NORC poll, a National Opinion Research Center poll, that found these striking partisan reactions to these cultural changes. So what they found is that two-thirds of Democrats, when they asked about what kind of culture is important for American identity, and I think that's the key question here, two-thirds of Democrats cited the mixing of cultures and values from around the world. Like, that's what makes America unique and what makes America strong. When they asked Republicans about this, two-thirds of Republicans said a culture grounded in Christian religious beliefs was the thing that made America strong.
And is the implied word there white Christian?
I think it is. Yeah, you know, that has always been the sort of this white Anglo-Saxon and in fact, Protestant, and not just Christian, but kind of actually Protestant culture, this WASPy identity that has served as, I think, the cultural center of the country and is now no longer really tenable. And so I think what we're fighting over in our partisan politics is what comes next.
How do you think Trump managed to glom onto this and to exploit it so as finally to win the election?
Yeah, you know, I think what happened is, you know, we'd always been thinking about Republican voters. I mean, they self-identified ever since kind of George W. Bush, especially as values voters, right? And that's the way that I think social scientists and the media had kind of come to be thinking about them. You know, in this election, that sort of went by the wayside. And, you know, what I sort of have arguing is that voters, right, that what became important for them was less that Donald Trump represented for them, you know, an evangelical Christian character example. He certainly did not do that. But he did say to them, I'm going to restore this version of America that you feel like you've lost, where white Christians really were at the top of the heap, top of the pyramid, and really had control of the culture.
But this, you write, is not the first time this has happened.
No, certainly. In some ways, we have been here before, right? So, you know, the most prominent thing is the Civil War, right? And we're still fighting this battle, right? There's in the news right now removal of Confederate monuments from New Orleans, for example, the removal of the Confederate flag from South Carolina in the last couple of years.
Which they had to do in the deep of night with all kinds of guards around them.
Yeah. So, you know, in some ways, the vestiges of this are still with us, you know, and that was a huge fight over who the country is, who's going to get to participate, who counts, who doesn't. I think all those questions are still really on the table. I mean, the other time this happened really was at the turn of the 20th century, a little more recently, when we had large numbers of European immigrants, especially Irish, Italian immigrants, Eastern European Jews coming into the country. And if you go back and look at the political cartoons from the newspapers around the early part of the 20th century, I mean, you see all kinds of threat. Right. The threat and Italians are portrayed as kind of dark skinned, swarthy foreigners. Right. That threaten American values and culture. I think we're experiencing a lot of that same thing today. And again, it's worth noting that it is true that today in the early part of the 20th century, the percent of foreign born Americans was about 15%. And that went down because we passed a lot of really restrictive immigration policies in the 1920s, but they got removed largely in the 1960s. And since that time, the number of foreign-born Americans has been creeping up, and we're back almost at that level of 15%. I think that's part of what's going on. But here's what's different. I think today we don't have a strategy available to us that we had in those present times, and that is we don't have a strong white Christian majority that can sort of serve as a target for assimilation, right? So one of the things that marked early immigrant groups was that they assimilated toward is kind of the whole metaphor of the melting pot, right? Is that that was the expectation, that people would shed their kind of particularities, come toward this American ideal that at the end of the day was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant ideal. And in exchange for that, they would get a seat at the table. But that today, that strategy today, because we no longer have this solid majority you know, white Christian culture isn't really a strategy that is really available anymore.
Now, what I heard on NPR recently is that on college campuses around the country, there is the rise of this, we want our nation back again. We are white Christians. We will take it back. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that it's important for us as a country, I think, to say this is about something real. I think the temptation on the left is to say, you know, just dismiss it and, come on, don't be racist, don't be bigoted. But it's important to note that these are real changes and they're fast changes. And we should expect that there are some fears, some anxieties as we go. And I think what we've got to figure out is, how can we sort of address those anxieties and fears, name them for what they are, and find a way to move ourselves forward, as we've done at other places in our history?
So from your perspective, how do we move forward?
Well, you know, I'm troubled about this.
Yeah, because, we all are.
Yeah, particularly when I look at the composition of the parties and the extreme polarization that we have today. And what's notable about partisan polarization in the country today is that it's not that everybody loves their own party. That's not what is driving partisan polarization. It's that we hate the other party, right? That's what is pushing us into our corners. This is a great study that was done in the 1960s by some Stanford political scientists, and they asked people, how upset would you be if your son or your daughter married someone of the opposite political party? The numbers were like 5% of Democrats and 6% of Republicans said they'd be very upset. The last time this question actually got asked was in the middle of the Obama administration. It's half. So it has increased 10 times since the 1960s. And you know, you could just test yourself, right? So if you meet someone new and the first thing you find out about them is their party identification, what are you going to load into your mind about what you think you know about that person from that one piece of information, right? If you hear that they're the same party view, you're going to feel probably immediately some affinity. You're going to think you enjoy all kinds of values. If you hear they're from the opposite political party, you probably immediately have this kind of visceral you know, kind of stiffening of the spine effect.
Unless you're Mary Madeline and James Carville, who have made a profession out of being of the opposite party.
Right, yeah, yeah. And there's very few of those couples out there today. You know, we look at couple voting behavior, it's more and more, you know, they share political outlooks. And I think it's because what that data points to is that, you know, a few decades ago, not that long ago, political partisanship was something that people took to the ballot box with them. And I think increasingly today, it's something we take to bed with us.
And that makes it far more difficult to get beyond. It seems to me, Robbie, that the only way we are going to manage to move forward is to begin to open our heads, our minds, and our hearts to listening to the other in ways that we haven't been able to do since the election process began.
Yeah, I think that's right. The challenge is that we are increasingly in our little bubbles, you know, and what we're facing, I think maybe the clearest way that I've been able to understand it, we're facing a set of tribal temptations, right, to kind of just sort ourselves into these tribes. And tribes kind of will fight to the death because there's not much place for compromise once it gets construed that way. I'm a little, you know, when I look at, for example, you just take this kind of white Christian identity we've been talking about, and you look at the Democratic Party today, the parties are sorting themselves this way, right? So Democrats, only 29% of Democrats identify as white and Christian, but 75% of Republicans identify as white and Christian. So, you know, it's a really unhealthy thing for democracy to have two, you know, when we only have two political parties, that's dangerous enough, as our founding fathers like saw, for divisions. You know, if we had six political parties, you might worry a little bit less, right, because there'd be a lot of give and take. But when there's only two and it's a binary, to have them sort themselves along lines of race and religion, two of the most powerful kind of social forces that we have, is a pretty dangerous thing for democracy.
Okay, dangerous. How? What do you see as the possible dangerous outcome?
Yeah, I think it turns politics into a winner-take-all affair. You know, and so what we do is we the parties then organize themselves around tactical victories that have party victory as the end and not a party that's putting together the best plan for the country at the end of the day. And so, you know, we win, you lose, zero sum. Politics is what we end up with. And then we end up with a lot of really disaffected and disgruntled people, no matter who wins the election, because then there's very little incentive to reach across the aisle to someone on the other side.
But surely that has to reach an end point where people recognize that nothing happens that is for the good of all.
Yeah, well, I hope we're getting there. You know, I think we're at a really dangerous place. And I think it's because we are dealing with very real changes. I don't want to minimize that at all. But I do think we've got to find some ways. You know, we think about our national motto, like E Pluribus Unum, right? Out of many, one. And that project, I think we've got to really take that up, because I think we're in danger of kind of trading this kind of praiseworthy, you know, E Pluribus Unum to kind of a paranoid E Pluribus Duo kind of approach to politics. And I think that's going to lead us nowhere good.
One last question, and that is in regard to the French election, which was held recently. Do you think that that holds some similarities to what we're talking about here in the U.S.? Mm.
Yeah, you know, I'm always a little bit cautious to going to Brexit or, you know, the French elections or the Dutch elections that had Geert Wilders, a very similar candidate to Marine Le Pen in France. But clearly there's something similar going on, and that is this reaction, right? But what's notable about this is that if you go, again, you go back to the early 20th century, people like de Tocqueville and G.K. Chesterton, who came from Europe to the U.S., they came here because they saw us doing something that they were having trouble doing in Europe. And that was this kind of mixing of all kinds of people. And the thing that held us together was not ethnicity or bloodlines or those kinds of things, which was right at the center of European politics. The thing that held us together was a sense of political principles, like outlined in the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and that we were able to kind of, you know, hold ourselves together with this set of beliefs, not a set of identities. And I think that is the project we've got to figure out how to take up.
Robbie, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
And now from the archives, as the editors of the Wall Street Journal noted in an opinion piece earlier this week, President Trump has subjected the country to weeks of pointless melodrama and undisciplined comments, which have prompted even some of his strongest supporters to question whether he's up to the demands of the job. Last summer, more than 2,200 psychologists signed an online manifesto warning about what they saw as Donald Trump's unfitness to be president. Here's William Daugherty, a psychologist at the University of Minnesota, and then Amy Nutt of The Washington Post. They spoke on The Diane Rehm Show last August.
In Minnesota, we had a governor who was a wrestler and a celebrity named Jesse Ventura. And one of the things we learned, and this is, I think, true of Donald Trump's public behavior, is a brittleness in the face of criticism, which is a terrible thing in a public figure, a counterattack. This is a kind of a leadership image that he is portraying that I think is deeply unhealthy and needs to be called out. Whatever the underlying traits are, the underlying psychopathology, if he has it, we need to be talking about how we treat each other in this country and what our leaders demonstrate about how we treat each other.
Amy.
Yeah, following up on what Bill's saying, it's interesting to note, and obviously we have such a range of things to pull from in terms of interviews and videos going back 20, 30 years with Donald Trump. But one thing he has made clear on several occasions is that he has said his greatest thrill in life is getting even. Without obviously even referring, you know, to narcissism, I think many people see that obviously as a troubling characteristic.
You can listen to that entire show at dianereem.org. That's our show for this week. Let us know what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, or send us an email to drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.